Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control now. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem, he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Got the static on the brain, out of control now. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Got the static on the brain.
Hello and welcome to the fifth episode of Jughead's Basement, featuring the 1985 release of Tom Waits' ninth record, Rain Dogs. Tom Waits was born in 1949. His first album, Closing Time, was released when he was only 23 years old. By the time he began to record Rain Dogs, he was a well-seasoned writer of many different styles, covered by musicians such as Tim Buckley, Bruce Springsteen, and the Eagles. Later bands to have covered Tom Waits from his over 20 record catalog have been Lydia Lunch, The Violent Femmes, Johnny Cash, Queens of the Stone Age, Steve Earle, The Ramones, my own band, even in blackouts, and etc., etc. Waits wrote the majority of the songs on Rain Dogs in a two-month stint in the fall of 1984 in a basement room at the corner of Washington and Horatio Streets in Manhattan. In a time when popular bands were making the transition into synthesizers, high-tech electronic drums, and samples, Tom Waits preferred to use the world that was around him. He said, "If I want a sound, I usually feel better if I've chased it and killed it, skinned it and cooked it." In regards to sampling sounds, he said, "I would rather go in the bathroom and hit the door with a piece of 2x4 very hard." This attitude may be one of the elements that helps to make this album so unique. Rain Dogs continues a style that had been begun on his record just prior called Swordfish Trombone, which would change the shape of much of his musical stylings to come, and what would cement his legacy amongst the few radical musicians to keep growing, changing, and creating vital, volatile music for more than four decades. This program will always be dictated by the order of the songs that appear on the album that is being featured. My good friends have spent much time contemplating the effect of Rain Dogs on their lives, and they have all chosen specific songs that spoke directly to them. We now present to you Rain Dogs.
Tom Waits is here. Nice to have you back. Thank you for being here. You living in New York now?
Yeah, living here.
You lived in Los Angeles for a long time, didn't you?
Yeah, I was there for a long time.
You lived in a hotel?
I lived a lot of different places.
Did you ever live in a car in L.A.?
Well, for a brief time, I think everybody's lived in a car for a
Do you feel more like you're a part of this city than L.A.?
Well, let's see. I lived on 14th Street. That made me feel a part of the city.
Yeah.
Right over there by the Armory, across from the Salvation Army there.
How would you describe the city?
Well, it's like a big ship, and the water's on fire.
These pieces, first and foremost, are each writer's individual takes on how a specific song has inspired them. You will hear truths, fictions, personal tales, lyrical analytics, and biographies of the auto nature and of the Tom Waitsian kind. The first track will be presented by New York neo-futurist Ryan Good, who just got back from a trip to Singapore, and if I'm not mistaken, he wrote and recorded this piece on the road. So here is Ryan Good with the album opener, Singapore.
It starts with the screech of a harrowed bird and an engine powered by xylophone and trombone. You hear something mysterious and mechanical, clanging, antiquated, falling to pieces, yet moving like an ancient railway ghost locomotive. Confusing foreign words bellow, spoken by a confident narrator who has traveled everywhere from Chinaman bars to the shores of Paris, but seems to have no idea where he's going. He warns all of us, wide-eyed, foolish listeners, of what is ahead, advising us to bring our blankets from the floor, fill our pockets with earth, because once you leave, you will need the things you can't have once you set sail, and they all turn to fog and Italian dreams. He warns us repeatedly that they're all mad as hatters, but welcomes us aboard as long as we don't sleep through the moment the iron boat sets sail, bound for a place called Singapore. I'm a bit of a vagabond right now. For nearly a year, I've had nothing that would be referred to as a home or a job, but have been stumbling, occasionally by iron boat, but more often by tattered buses and rickety budget planes, from country to country, repeatedly discovering that there is no universal truth to be found, but there are dozens of viable ways to wipe your ass. I've always thought of Tom Waits and Rain Dogs in particular as traveling music. His marching rhythms find their way into my ears on many a plane flight. His piano ballads of loneliness, a parallel to the feelings of the cold sterility of a low to mid-range lodging bed as your dining place, masturbation hub, and refuge from all the information around. Occasionally, Tom is so apropos for a moment that you have no choice but to give in to the lyrical connection between his words and your world. On a trip to Ushuaia, Argentina, a place that fancies itself the southernmost city on the globe, I sat in a non-sexually shared hostel bed with one of my dearest mates at an unknown AM hour slugging giant beers, singing Bottom of the World, along with the tinny sound coming out of his oversized headphones at full volume.
And I love the bottom of the world.
Moments earlier, we had foraged into what we believed to be the southernmost casino in the world, losing small amounts of money rapidly, and the southernmost strip club in the world, where I chatted and fell a bit in love with Zoe, who told me of her love for Bob Dylan and her sadness that the men didn't remember her name. As the night ended, the next morning beginning, I stopped in the street in drunken latitudinal amazement to stare at the giant snowflakes that had begun to fall, joyously yelling at the sky, "Where the hell am I?" I hoped we were doing Tom proud. Singapore is like that. So when I landed in the city of the same name, the oompa, oompa, oompa-pa played repeatedly on my cerebral stereo. The song is about heading on a long journey, about saying goodbye to those things and people which you know. Right now it feels like it's basically about me. And I think that in some way I wanted to find Tom Waits' world out there instead of the real one. I wanted to find a world that had dirt under its tattered fingernails. The world that was a bit cooler to hang out in because you might get stabbed there. Was Singapore this place? Better things have come from more foolish logic. Singapore was a national anthem to me. A representative melody about a place I truly knew nearly nothing about, but had created a fully formed idea of strictly from the song. Strange man-beasts would walk the shadowy alleys. Camel meat would be served as a delicacy, consumed with a glass of the liquid it stores in its hump. Pirates would fill the bars, paying their tabs with gold coins from recently captured booty. Albino midgets would sniffle from doing too much cocaine, and the mustachioed women would caress you with soft hands, offering you a sex act you'd never heard of before for a currency that didn't exist. But what I hadn't realized was that Tom's narrator doesn't arrive in Singapore by the time the 165 seconds of the song completes. He's merely just left. If he had arrived, he would have found this. Singapore is pristine and organized and really quite dull. Their passport control and airport are efficiently run. Their taxis charge by the meter and take the most efficient route. And for entertainment, most of the locals go to hang out in one of the dozens of malls they have. Ah. So when I swung open the old wooden door of the Cadillac bar on the Friday night we arrived, I did not have high hopes. The floors and walls are carpeted and red, but the preponderance of space is taken up by the dance floor. A dance floor, I might add, that is packed with Malaysians and Japanese and American expats and somewhere, I can only assume, a few locals whose parents and grandparents were born here. When I walked in, I gave a little ironic chuckle. I've been traveling the world. I'm from Brooklyn. I can't possibly be entertained by a cover band rapidly ripping through Western classics backed by a soulless drone of a pre-recorded drum track, right? But I look around, and they are all shaking their asses like it's a multicultural bar mitzvah to the strains of YMCA and Cat Scratch Fever and Wonderful Tonight. And you know what? They were spectacular. Not pitchfork, hipster, blog-worthy, hot new band, but joyous and danceable, and made me drink my beer faster and smile along with them. I didn't hear them play any Tom Waits that night, much less Singapore itself, but it wouldn't have made any sense anyways. We were in an imaginary, magical place, where grandmothers were beckoning you to writhe up against them, where the change for your pitcher of beer came twice and you overtipped accordingly, where a Ted Nugent song wasn't so cringeworthy you walked out immediately like a fifth grader during a slow song at the school dance. It was a bit of humanity in a land of sterility. This was Singapore.
Later in this episode, you will hear one of the writers talk about a couple of musicians who recorded on Rain Dogs with Tom Waits. For now, here is just a quote from one of them. Tom Waits, as producer, apart from himself as writer and singer and guitar player, he brings in his ideas, but he's very open to sounds that suddenly and accidentally occur in the studio. I remember one verbal instruction being, "Play it like a midget's bar mitzvah." And with that said, here is Greg Allen, Neo-Futurist founder and playwright, with his interpretation of the second track on the record, Clap Hands.
"That is an excellent question, Jimmy," Mr. Knickerbocker replied, taking off his round spectacles and wiping them with the handkerchief he kept in his pocket for that very purpose. He fixed his glasses back over his ears and fixated on the small crowd of children gathered around him on the ground. He had held their rapt attention for the good part of an hour. "Applause," he continued, "was not always a desired response. In fact, its origin is quite the opposite, dating back to the Roman Empire. It is said that Emperor Tiberius was so sensitive to the screams of the dying in the Colosseum that he would instinctively place his hands over his ears right before the victim met his doom, whether by gladiator's spear or in the jaws of a lion. He finally figured out that, rather than endure it, he could command his minions to drown out the insufferable noise by smacking their palms together repeatedly, making such a clamor that he could no longer hear the howls of death. Thus, applause was born, and soon it became not just a tool to squelch the screams of the dying, but one to precipitate its occurrence, as when the Romans clapped their hands to express their desire for someone's quick demise. Christians learned to dread this noise so intensely that occasionally they would drop dead at its very sound. This is where we get the violent metaphors for stage performance. Dying on stage, slaying the audience, or knocking them dead. Soon this practice became common in all entertainment. Audiences would applaud just before the climax of any action. This tradition endures today in our sporting events. Over time, however, it shifted in the theater to the end of the show so as not to disrupt the narrative, serving to symbolize the death of the play itself and not its participants." Mr. Knickerbocker twiddled his hat between his ragged fingers, wondering if he should take it easy with the vocabulary so as not to leave his diminutive audience behind. But so far, so good, they remained hanging on his every word. "Have you ever noticed that in Eastern European and former Soviet countries, audiences applaud in rhythm?" He looked for a knowing nod, but received none. "This was ingrained during the communist era when uniformity in all things was mandated and strictly enforced. The state even went so far as to hire applause leaders at every theater, ensuring that everyone stayed on rhythm with equal hand intensity. These men were called applauditors. At the time, those with a poor sense of rhythm were often fined, and those who were thought to deliberately disrupt the unity were sometimes imprisoned or hanged. It is little known that the Nobel Prize winner Alexander Solzhenitsyn was not sent to the gulags because of his incendiary novels, but because of his poor clapping." Here Mr. Knickerbocker thought he noticed in his little cadre of avid followers, a bit of uneasy shifting and possibly a stifled yawn. A learned speaker, he knew this was his cue to wrap it up, for he did not want to overstay his welcome. As he stood to fold up his camping stool, the old man concluded, "One should never forget that arguably the greatest moment in the history of theater is where, by the sheer force of their applause, the audience is able to bring a character back to life. I am, of course, referring to the pending death of Tinkerbell in the last act of J.M. Barrie's beloved Peter Pan. After she has drunk the poison intended for him, Peter looks to the audience and asks that, if we believe in fairies, we should clap our hands very, very hard and possibly cause Tinkerbell to come back to life. We clap like madmen to prove our faith in fairies and to ensure Tinkerbell's immortality. Just like Peter, she will never die as long as one child remains in the audience clapping. Ironically, this is the very opposite purpose of its origin. Applause brings us not a death, but a life and resurrection. Placing his crumpled hat upon his head, his stool beneath his arm, Mr. Knickerbocker prepared to depart. I leave you with Puck's final words. So good night unto you all. Give me your hands if we be friends, and Robin shall restore amends. Despite his kind request, and although he bowed low, no hands were put together. He was met with silence as his little audience sat there stoically. Without concern, he bent over again, gathered his little crowd, folded them back together, and placed them in his pocket. As he meandered into the street, the car horns were drowned out by the thunderous rhythmic applause in his head.
Scene, scene, the whole in scene. Fireman's blind, the conductor's lean. A Cincinnati jacket and a sad look dean. Hanging out the window with a bottle full of rain. Clap hands.
Rain Dogs has 19 tracks on the album. I had made the decision not to get 19 different writers, or else this podcast would be longer than I would have liked it, knowing that these writers would want to write a piece longer than 2 to 4 minutes. So what I have done is that occasionally you will hear just a snippet of a song that has no writer. And here is the first of those, Cemetery Polka. Joe Janes is a Chicago actor, sketch writer, and teacher of the Second City persuasion. I'm very happy to finally have him upon the Jughead's Basement show. So here is Joe Janes with track 4, Jockey Full of Bourbon.
Stumbling, the herky-jerky lock-kneed forward chunking of gravity's push down the sidewalk. It's starting to rain, which is good. I thought it was bleeding. Having to focus and listen and try not to slur my words is not the desired effect I desire. Oh God, steps. Been here before. Thoughts are clear in my head. They just come out damaged, scratched and dented, missing a few parts. The last sliver of sense kicks in. Too late. I have left the party. I just got up and left. No goodbyes. Leave before I pee on the toilet seat or pass out in a chair or vomit on upholstery. Or tell someone they should really know who I am. Or to enthusiastically tell Miss Teagarden, the bartender, how lovely she is. She is. But I heroically keep it to myself. I'm pretty sure she is. I've never seen her in the daylight. I really shouldn't be driving. If I make it home, which I probably will, I've done this before. It's a good bet. I'll wake up naked in my closet, burst in, scare the cat, tear off all my clothes like they're on fire, and pass out on a pile of laundry. Sweet and dirty laundry. I'll call in sick or work through the pain, or call in sick. Right now, I stumble into a cold, dreamless sleep. I'm in the corner on the
Next up is Don Hall, and coincidentally, I don't think any of us knew, his piece comes right after Joe Jane's. The two of them have been working together since longer than I can remember. The two of them have created many great plays at WNEP Theater. Don Hall is a storyteller, cultural organizer, events producer, provocateur, podcaster, actor, director, and generally a pleasant guy to hang with. That's from his site, which can be found at donhall.blogspot.com. Here is the aforementioned Don Hall bringing us the fifth track, Tango Till They're Sore.
When I was a child, I began having hallucinations. I was 5 years old, and I can recall just barely the illusion of spiders crawling all over my body. What I didn't know, and what my mother found out shortly, was that I had spinal meningitis, a disease known as the child killer in the late 1960s. My pediatrician, remarkably named Dr. Blood, told my then 20-year-old mother that it was a medical certainty that I would die of this degenerative monster, and if by luck or miracle I did not die, I would survive with blindness, deafness, severe brain damage, or physical disability. Well, I beat the ridiculously low odds and grew up with my mother insisting that I was special because of it. For years, my case was listed in the Kansas Journal of Medicine as an unexplained recovery. I was meant for something. Yes, I was saved by the universe. Later, when my mother found God, I was saved by divine intervention. And thus began the myth. Somehow I got it in my head that I would not die until I was 45 years old. But there was a certainty, that I would not last a minute past 45. I don't know why I came up with that number. There was really nothing significantly important about it. I believed it, though, with the same nonchalant faith that Christians believe in a virgin birth. There's so little doubt in my mind that the reality of my death became background for everything I did, every choice I made.
Well, you play that tarantella, all the hounds will start to roar. The boys all go to hell, and then the Cubans hit the floor. They drive along the pipeline, they tangle to their sore. They take apart their nightmares and they leave them by the door. Let me fall out of the window with confetti in my hair. Deal out jacks of bed on a blanket by the stairs. I tell you all my secrets, but I lie about my past. And send me off to bed forevermore.
I'm now 47 years old. I beat the odds again. I'm faced with an unknowable future, and I have no fucking idea what to do with that. I mean, there was comfort in my certainty. It's now gone. When I die, will they tangle till they're sore? I know for everyone there's a window to fall from, confetti in our hair, and the only thing I can be concerned with is that when I fall, I'm not spending my last moment in this flawed body thinking about bullshit, bills or petty slights or any number of the countless distractions life holds. In fact, I hope I'm singing a song or telling a story or having sex. I hope I'm teaching someone something useful or eating a delicious meal or having sex. I hope they play my theme song. I hope all the hounds start to roar. And while I don't have a clarinet, I hope you put my trumpet beneath your bed.
Tell you all my secrets, but I lie about my past. Will you send me off to bed forevermore? Send me off of bed forevermore.
And now for the sixth track, brought to you by me, John Jughead Pearson. Here is Black Mariah. Is it Catholic or is it Protestant? It has something to do with Christ, this idea that to think through a sin is to commit that very sin. If this is so, I first became a thief when I was a freshman in high school. For some strange reason, the principal allowed a big truck of road-weary salesmen to come into our school and sell illegal imitation concert shirts in the hallways. In between classrooms, I stood at the table, loaded with concert merchandise, eyeing a Black Sabbath t-shirt, probably Masters of Reality, and a Michael Schenker Group t-shirt with probably just the letters MSG in red and black. Two bands that I have failed to see to this very day. I gave up concert going for playing on stage myself. Once I was on stage, my mom used to say, there was no getting me off. I wanted one of those shirts, or both, but I had no money, and I couldn't steal them. Oh, there was no moral imperative keeping my spiritual hands tied behind my judicial back. It was pure fear of being caught, of being labeled a thief, like my brothers. I was the good one. The one expected not to steal concert shirts off a table in the hallway of my high school during broad daylight. And that is what I remained. The son who did not steal those shirts. But I coveted the shit out of them. I stood there guilty from first moment to last, sweating, thinking of ways to pocket them, when to make it happen, waiting for a distraction. The distractions, they came and they went. I could never have gotten away with it. The bearded, smelly carny behind the counter eating McDonald's out of a bag could smell my fear over the grease of his fries. Repeatedly, after each period of the school day, I made my way to that table. The carny became more familiar with me as the day progressed, and my imagined broken commandment took shape and form. I was not a customer to him. He quickly became aware of what I really was. A thief in waiting, eternally guilty, eternally damned. A Black Mariah is a British slang term for a police van used to transport criminals, but in New Orleans, it has come to mean an old-fashioned hearse transporting a dead man. Why do I remember this one day so vividly? One out of thousands of other days, past, present, and future, that I did not steal. This day is ingrained in my brain, most definitely till my dying day. That day, the day I did not steal. I remember it because it is the first time I can recall wanting to steal. It reminds me that I am not what I appear to be. I am a Johnny in a wooden jacket, dead while still alive, guilty, sheathed in a flimsy coat of innocence. Does this fall from grace seem petty? The smallest of uncommitted crimes? Do you think you know me that well now? Do you know me at all? Is it possible for me to be dead to you? If you never even knew I existed? If you never knew that I didn't steal? And finally, do you find it believable that years later I worked at a record store and the first thing that I did actually steal was a cassette tape of Rain Dogs? Was I any more guilty than I already had been prior? Am I any more alive than my non-existence that is infinitely longer and more permanent than the fleeting thoughts I have now or the ephemeral actions I have and will continue to commit until my dying day? If my mother ever listens to this podcast, which she won't, will she send me off to bed without supper? I first saw this performer at a Chicago performance called Right Club, where he posited the importance of Santa Claus over Jesus Christ. And then again, a few years later, I saw him posit the importance of Jesus Christ over Santa Claus. Right then, I discovered that this man could write about anything from either side. So here is Mike O'Connell, writer and performer, with his rendition of
Track 7,
Diamonds and Gold.
I was so late to the game in regards to Rain Dogs that I would have been ejected were the game to have any referees or were it a game at all. My tardiness in discovering it, however, seemed to have been planned by some omniscient higher power. I hold the unconventional opinion that gods who have lost all of their followers, gods who have become obsolete, are relegated to the job of music supervisor to humanity. They watch and wait and place an album or song in your view when you need it most, when it will illuminate your experience in just the right way. Such was the case with Rain Dogs and myself.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Many moons ago, after my undistinguished collegiate career came to an unspectacular conclusion, I was living in Evanston, Illinois, in what one could call a boarding house, or if one preferred to call it as such, a men's hotel. It was $150 a month, cash only, which garnered me a small room with a shared kitchen and bathroom. It was that year that I discovered Rain Dogs. It was also that year that the bygone gods decided to inform me that I was living right in the middle of one of the songs. Those whom I shared this bathroom and kitchen with were a motley crew, to be sure. There was an English list Chinese man who was studying at Northwestern and did not grasp very well the hive of weirdness he had been thrust into. There was Carl, a man whose mind had left him years before if it had ever taken up residence in his head to begin with. And finally, there was Billy Ray. Billy Ray was a local panhandler who was so well-liked around town that the owner of the boarding house gave him a room there free of charge. It was not uncommon for me to leave a restaurant with friends or after a date only to hear someone say in a voice engineered to excite maximum pity, "I am homeless. I don't do drugs or drink. Can you spare some change so I can get something to eat?" This sentence was so riddled with lies that it always made me smile. He had a home. He drank like a demon from hell. He had had 4 heart attacks from smoking crack, and he only ate food that I would leave in the communal refrigerator. Billy Ray, upon realizing that it was me, would say, "Hey, Mike, you don't need to give me no change. By the way, I might have accidentally drank all of your beer and finished that sandwich that seemed as if it was many days past its expiration date. See you back at the place." Many dates and even more friends were highly confused that I was living with the local hobo. As the year wore on and I continued to listen endlessly to Rain Dogs, I began to realize that I was sharing a bathroom with the small-time Napoleon, referenced in Diamonds and Gold. Billy Ray dreamed big about small things. He would have many powwows with the half-wit Carl at the kitchen table, becoming more excited as he became more drunken, making boastful claims that he would someday make his way to Chicago, a city, by the way, that was no more than 10 blocks from our humble abode. "Someday, Carl, when you get your next disability check, you and I are gonna go to Chicago. We're gonna wear suits, and we're gonna eat steaks, and we're gonna get ourselves all kinds of women." Just because he had no money or prospects did not mean he wasn't ambitious. He had a broken cell phone that he had found in the garbage, on which I would often see him engaging in long and important conversations with imaginary businessmen. Throwing out figures in the millions and doing his best imitation of the most serious of CEOs. He even, for a short time, attempted to be a pimp to a YMCA hooker. A knock came on my door one evening, and I opened it to reveal Billy Ray and a very shy, very busty lady next to him. "This is Clara. Show him your tits, Clara." The shy woman showed me her heaving bosom in possibly the least sexual display of mammaries I have ever witnessed. "Now, if you ever want to get with Clara, you let me know." To this day, I have yet to invoke his generous coital offer. I feel that I might have ruined his pimping career. Now, Billy Ray is not the only small-time Napoleon by a long shot. The world is full of small-time Napoleons who struggle to make a dime and go to absurd lengths just to eke out a meager existence. They walk through hell with the idea that someday, once they have suffered enough, they will be met with some great reward. We are all this small-time Napoleon, and Mr. Waits is so attuned to the human comedy that he sees in this both sadness and beauty. Along with Mr. Waits, I must thank those long unworshipped gods who were kind enough to place this album and song in my earshot at this moment in my life. They have made me realize how important it is to have empathy towards even the most downtrodden of humanity. For as the song so beautifully puts it, we are all wounded, but we just keep on climbing.
Track 8 has no writer. It is one of my favorite songs on the record. It is called Hang Down Your Head. I was originally going to write a piece for this one, but what I had in mind fit better with Black Mariah. I used to play this record when I worked at a coffee shop, Gloria Jean's Coffee Bean, back in 1986. And I used to love how everyone would turn their heads when they heard it. Most of them cringing their faces going, "What the hell is this?" I never quite understood that because I took to his voice immediately and never found anything too strange about it. It just seemed right. Jen Ellison is a fascinating Chicago actor, writer, performer, director. I've never ceased to be amazed by what she will do next. If you Google her name, you'll be able to find a few different blog spots that she hosts. They're all pretty funny and creative, of course. So here is Jen Ellison with the 9th track on the record, Time.
Well, the smart money's on Harlem, and the moon is in the street. The shadow boys are breaking all the laws. And you're east of East St. Louis, and the wind is making speeches, and the rain sounds like a round of applause. And Napoleon is weeping in the carnival saloon. His invisible fiance's in the mirror. And the band is going home, it's raining.
The apartment on 1153 West Webster was a ramshackle construction of stucco, matted orange shag, and cracked, leaded yellow paint.
And it's time, time, time. And it's time, time, time. And it's time, time, time.
My roommate, Colleen, and I moved into it in the fall of 1994, and we stayed there until we both graduated from college. Most Saturdays were spent on the living room floor, drinking beer and watching each other play a form of solitaire we called one quick game. The game was never quick and often unwinnable. We would talk about anything and everything that came to our young brains, wondering whether, in an infinite universe, given enough time, Hitler would still be in hell, etc., etc. The rain would fall outside. Colleen hugged her knees to her while she smoked her Parliament. I'd flip over some cards, and Tom Waits played out of our tiny drugstore CD player. We were lousy with time back then. We could spend it any way we wanted to and still have the audacity to say that we didn't have enough. We longed for longing in the way that kids do, hoping that one day all the melancholy would amount to something. Time was long and often excruciating, waiting for the next thing to happen. Now, I don't have any. No time to let my mind wander, no time to stare at the ceiling and listen to music and wonder what's going to happen next. If we lived in 1985, when we lived in 1985, this album was released then, and it would have been on cassette or vinyl. Time comes right at the end of side A. It seems so ridiculous now to stop the machinery, flip, rewind, or fast forward, drop the needle on the groove in the wax. We had to work for our music back then. At the end of side A, time plays and ends and stops, and in the silence, as you fit the eye of the record onto the spindle, time continues, and whether you are of a mind to or even realizing it, time has forced you to contemplate it, and how when you were 20 years old, you were really disappointed that it wasn't a love song, like a love-love song, between a boy and a girl love song, but it is a love-love song, and I was just too young, and I had no history, only the future, which is now, and now, and now, and now I'm running late, and there is no time to ruminate on the image of the boys diving off the cars and splashing into the rippling street, which is animated in my mind from the very first time I heard the song, which isn't about time at all, but about memory, and the memory of a memory, and this is exactly the kind of thing we would spend hours talking over as the cigarettes burned, and the cards were played, and her hair turned from orange to auburn in the fading afternoon light, and the smell of our apartment was full of smoke, old and new, and there is no way of knowing what will wash up from the things that you can't remember. And was the money we put on Harlow really so smart, Colleen? I can see that L train getting smaller as it goes away because I didn't carve out enough time to get here. And when the record or tape is fitted, and you drop the needle or press play, time is gone, and you are swept into the vorticular future of Rain Dogs.
It's time.
Next up is Chicago neo-futurist Bilal Dardai. He is a playwright, an essayist, and a performer. This is his first time joining us on Jughead's Basement, but he can also be heard on our other podcast, The Hole in 30 Days. Here is Bilal Dardai with track 10, or the first track of side 2 of a cassette or vinyl LP, Rain Dogs.
That it's a real thing at first, a rain dog. I think it's just a phrase, a clever turn. I tend to think that dog is one of those words that you can put pretty much any noun in front of and you will create something interesting, like diamond or reservoir. It's a word that, when put with this other noun, creates a phrase that you don't necessarily understand, but you kind of grasp, like a shadow at the other end of a tunnel slowly approaching you. And although you can't see exactly what it is, you do grasp the feeling of dread you have as it begins to accelerate. And that's what I think a rain dog is. It's that atmosphere.
Inside a broken clock, splashing the wine with all the rain dogs.
But I'm wrong. A rain dog is a real thing. A rain dog is a dog that has left its home and wandered about in the world. And at some point, a downpour has occurred, and it has erased the scent that the dog was using to track its way back home. And that dog is now lost in the world. And at first this is kind of tragic, the idea of a dog that has become lost because of simple weather, until you wonder if the dog had perhaps meant to do it on purpose. If the dog could feel the storm coming, as dogs often do, and many will hide under couches or hide in closets as they know the storm approaches. But maybe the rain dog knew the storm was coming and ran out, knowing it would not be able to find its way back, knowing it would be lost, knowing it would not be able to readily come back. And why it did it is not important. The point is that the dog is willfully lost, which is not an unusual topic for Tom Waits.
For I am a rain dog too.
Many of his songs are about being lost in oneself, being lost in the world, being willfully lost, being ignorant and lost. They are questions of, where am I going? Where was I going? There's the storyteller's question, hey, where was I? And it reminds me that I once knew a rain dog. I knew a dog, a rat terrier, a black and white rat terrier that my wife found wandering around in the rain, and it was literally maybe 10 pounds soaking wet, and she found it on a porch shaking and shivering, and she brought it home, and we kept it for a few days and realized we could not keep it more than a few days, as we already had two dogs that were at least a dozen times its size. And so we found a new home for the rain dog. We had the dog, we had named it Inca, and the home we found for it belonged to a woman who named the dog Indy instead. And the first few days that she had Indy, there were pictures all over the internet. There were pictures of Indy playing with a toy, and pictures of Indy playing with his new bed, and Indy just being Indy, this cute black and white rat terrier, and then nothing. Suddenly there were no more pictures of Indy. This woman is not a friend. This woman is a friend of a friend. And this woman is not somebody that I normally speak to. But I've always wondered what happened to Indy. Why there were no more pictures beyond that first week. If Indy had turned out to not be a match for that home. Or if Indy had in fact run away again in the midst of another rainstorm and was lost out there somewhere. And I want to know, where is the dog? Where is the dog? Where is the dog? But I can't ask that question.
You'll never be going back home.
Track number 11 is a sad little instrumental. It is sad because it has no writer. It is called Midtown, parentheses, instrumental, end of parentheses. Kara Francis is a New York neo-futurist and a writer and, of course, a performer, and from what I hear, likes to live right on the very edge. Here she is with her take on the 12th track, Ninth and Hennepin.
What's Ninth and Hennepin? All the donuts have names that sound like prostitutes. And the moon's teeth mark.
I'm going to tell you a little story here. It's about a place in Brooklyn, New York. Little Bermuda Triangle of South Williamsburg, Bushwick, Bed-Stuy, Fort Greene. It's one of those things where every person you always expected to see all the time is the guy who sells you your cereal and sandwiches, or is a stranger, or is your roommate. It's about a street corner called Hughes and Broadway. All the children around here are Orthodox. All the grown-ups are confused. It's the corner of where that dude you wanted to see over and over again showed up to work one day and fell in love with you and moved in. All the prostitutes around here had names that sounded like prostitutes, but they closed the crack hotel and wouldn't give me the sign as a novelty decoration for my apartment. And now the only dangerous woman near that astroturf is me, walking home at night with my hand on a tiny knife, thinking what I'll do to anybody who tries what one guy did once. And the rest of this poem could dissolve into rhythmic dude bro, babe, 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 dude bro, bro. They're here because of me, and the large apartments, and the hallway is so dirty it's okay to puke. So close to the city. And the initials CF and CL are in a heart in the sidewalk cement, right next to CL and the initials of someone else, which you swear you didn't do. The French-American bistro is fashionably dead on its corner. The brown rolls of paper from the matzo factory drip in the rain, and the train rolls over the line with the Dominicans on one side and the Hasids on the other, and the white kids stuffing their money in the faults and cracks. You could throw a rock and hit the projects with the arm of a smallish god. All the factories around here have rooms that look like condos now. Walls too thin for all that band practice. You take on the dreams of their bass lines. Everyone you dare to meet eyes with asks for directions. How far is it to Bedford Avenue? Or the youth hostel? Or what neighborhood is this? Is the train too loud? Or, hey, mommy. When they work on the tracks in the morning, the honks sound like elephants complaining to each other about what gentrification has done to the cost of an apartment their size. And no one talks about anything good in the bars around here. They all started off at day jobs. Or it's Spanish in the other ones, the ones where they sell roast chicken. No Yiddish in the night spots. Only nervous, impotent staring. And the girl on the fourth floor apartment is me. Furniture, plants, two fish, two birds, a roommate, a boyfriend, and a cat. Art supplies, books, a knick-knack collection. Nothing fly by night about it. My sister used to live here. But that, somehow, was too much. Nothing ever wrong with her $100 couldn't fix. Always thought that was true for anybody, though. The poor would have something. The rich would have all they needed. The supermarket rats are innocent. I never wanted that $100. Just for someone to see me and feel generous. And $100 is a little less than how much a metro card costs. Once a month, I make this city mine. I get sad when I can't remember how many it's been. Since I first heard Ninth and Hennepin, and thought to fix myself up some poem of a place.
An And now for one of Chicago's most darkly oriented writers and performers, Ian Belknap, who is also the founder of Write Club. So here is Ian Belknap with his take on track number 13, Gun Street Girl.
I think my relationship to music might be strange, but I don't know, because I've never asked anybody. I am what I would call amusical, by which I don't mean that I'm opposed somehow to music. I'm just without music. It's an idiom I don't speak. There's none inside me. I am not its habitat. When I hear a song, it's at first a totally sonic experience. This sounds obvious, of course, but what I mean is that my appreciation, if I have any, of the meaning of a song is slow in coming. The poetry of lyrics is lost on me. I can have heard a song 1,000 times and still have a really minimal sense of what a singer is saying to me. Even songs I love the sonic experience of. A good example of this is The Immigrant Song by Zeppelin. Love that tune. Love it. Crank it whenever it comes on. But after decades of listening to it, I have not a clue of what it's meant to be about. I feel like people who play music or listen to music more than I do, or who listen better than I do, maybe, have a fuller experience of music than I ever will. I feel like somebody who's colorblind, looking at a mural or something. I see a picture, but I don't really see the picture.
1, 2, 3. Falling James in the Tahoma. Stick around and tell us all the tale. Well, I fell in love with a Gun Street girl.
But there have been these rare times, so rare I can count them on one hand, when the sensory and the conceptual and the verbal all origami in my head in the right way. My brain does not usually make of a song the crane that is wanted. My brain will crease a song in a haphazard and probably stupid way, a childlike and fat-fingered wad of nonsense. Probably the most total ear, brain, heart origami happened when I first heard Rain Dogs. I was working as a picture framer in Amherst, Massachusetts. The owner of the shop was a pretty cosmopolitan type for such a small town. She watched foreign movies without being obligated to do so, and she traveled each year to France. Usually the stuff she played in the workroom back behind the gallery was sort of avant. I remember there was tons of Laurie Anderson, which sounded to me like glib, atonal slop. But when she played Rain Dogs on cassette, which obviously was the state of the art at the time, it was like an insane uncle walked into the room of my skull and hurled his angled body into the spongy chair of my brain. His laugh is like the wheezing bellows of a concertina, his face patchy with the rain-streaked remains of hastily applied clown makeup. He strikes a kitchen match on the wall of my skull and lights the first of many cigarettes. When Pearson approached me about this, I could have put all the song titles on a dartboard, and whichever one I hit blindfolded would have made me happy. Because Rain Dogs to me was this irreducible hole on endless repeat for like a year. But I settled on Gun Street Girl for a couple of reasons. The blacksmith percussion and its story of low-life crime. I don't know if they're hitting an anvil or the blade of a circular saw or what, but every time I hear this song, it makes me think of trying to chisel through leg irons. And if there's a more evocative line in any song ever than dyed his hair in the bathroom of a Texaco, I don't know what it is. I think we all have a shadow self, or we're some kind of criminal. Gun Street Girl quickens the pulse of this version of me that is a petty thief and blackmailer. The self that's a dirtbag who plays the angles and lives by his wits. The guy who knows how to take a beating and where to find a crooked doctor who can dig a slug out of you and keep his mouth shut about it. There's a part of me that always wants to be casing the joint, that is flinty and amoral enough to take you for everything. There's a part of me that's a bag man and a grifter, a shakedown artist and a racketeer. When I hear Gun Street Girl, that version of myself is rendered a little more plausible and present, a little more urgent and real. I'm given hope that this is a song written by a square citizen like myself, a guy with kids and obligations like me. I feel like if I keep digging, I might unearth that sketchy bastard within. I feel like if I stay on it, I can find that stick-up man and pickpocket, that prowler and punk. Maybe if I beat on a saw blade and pluck on a banjo, maybe I'll get there.
I said, John, John, he's long gone, gone to Indiana, he never coming home. I said, John, John, he's long gone, gone to Indiana.
Track number 14 is Union Square, another lonely song without a writer. One of the great things about this song is that I think it says the word down more than any other song that I know. Here's how it closes. Down, 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 I'm going down, 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 downtown, down, downtown, down, 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 come on, down, downtown, going down, downtown, I'm going down, downtown.
I'm going down.
Steve Walker has been on this podcast almost more than I have. I keep inviting him back because I think he is such a great writer. So here is Chicago and LA writer-actor Steve Walker with his take on track number 15.
Scattered thoughts on blind love. The consumption of music, literally, music is a product to be consumed, and how we react to that consumption is subjective and has nearly everything to do with who we are when we hear it.
Now you go.
It's over. That's established in the first three words of Blind Love. Now you're gone. The finality of it is harsh and uncompromising. There's just no getting around it and little to do.
I don't care if they miss me. I never remember their name.
He understood why she didn't want to see him over the holidays. She was going through a rough time. Well, so am I, he thought. But there was another thought in his head that seeing each other might make them both feel better. Maybe even point them in the direction of a future. That's gone now.
Must be blind love. Only kind of love is stone blind love.
Tom Waits has tackled all sorts of musical genres. Tin Pan Alley, jazz, show tunes, noise, scat, straight-ahead rock, blues, opera. This is his first shot at country music, but not the kind the Nashville elite would approve of. This is outlaw country in the Merle Haggard vein. But he's a tourist here, just visiting, much like the Rolling Stones would do in their middle period. It makes sense that Keith Richards is on guitar. They say if you get far enough away, you'll be on your way back home. He had been living far away from what he called home for about 5 years now. Despite the 2,000 miles between them, he still pined for her, thought about her every day. He hated where he lived now, felt out of place since he arrived, and spent much of the first couple years drunk and drugged up. When she came to visit him, it was a disaster. Bad timing has always been his Achilles heel.
Way to find you, see if I close my eyes.
The presence of Keith on the record is what is most remarked upon, but interwoven with the solid lead is another guitarist, Robert Quine. Quine is one of the most underappreciated and innovative guitarists. He played with Richard Hell as one of the Voidoids. He played with Lou Reed, Brian Eno, Marianne Faithfull. He played guitar on the Knee Pea by the great writer Lester Bangs, who said of him, "Someday Quine will be recognized for the pivotal figure that he is on his instrument. He is the first guitarist to take the breakthroughs of early Lou Reed and James Williamson and work through them to a new individual vocabulary, driven into odd places by obsessive attention to On the Corner era Miles Davis." They saw each other one Christmas when they were both in town. While it wasn't a train wreck, the feelings were tentative, neither wanting to put too many emotions on the line. After all, they lived so far away from one another. They had an awkward goodbye. It was the last time he saw her. Robert Quine would remain merely a cult figure, but a beloved one nonetheless. After he played with Tom Waits, who would do work with John Zorn, Matthew Sweet, they might be giants. But in the early 2000s, his wife passed away. Depressed after her death, he died of a suicide by heroin overdose. It's your blind love. Only kind of love is stone blind love. I wonder where you are, and I whisper your name. The only way to find you is if I close my eyes. He thinks of her, but he can't be her friend. He can only love her at this point, and he still does, despite all the reasons why he shouldn't. Must be blind love. The only kind of love is stone blind love. Stone blind love.
Many years ago, while I was wandering around North and Wells, I ran into this man, Matt Dwyer, coming out of Second City. He looked about as lost as I did, and I looked at my phone and said, "I don't know how to work this." And he said, "I don't know either." Here is Matt Dwyer, who is a writer, comedian, performer, and he also has his own podcast called Conversations with Matt Dwyer. Here he is with his take on track 16, Walking Spanish.
He got himself a homemade special. You know his glass is full of sand, and it feels just like a jaybird, the way it fits into his hand.
He wrote a blade of... I was your typical kid from the suburbs of Chicago. I wasn't very cultured. Chop suey carryout was about as exotic as my parents ever got. And when it came to music, I was a slight outsider, mostly because I liked big band jazz. Other than my departure into Benny Goodman, I liked all the typical music everyone else in Streamwood, Illinois enjoyed. You know, Led Zeppelin, The Doors, Rush, all that bullshit. As I got a little older, I got into The Clash, The Dead Milkmen, and The Violent Femmes before The Violent Femmes became the favorite of asshole frat boys everywhere. I loved these bands, but none of them spoke to me on a higher level. I mean, upon my discovery of them, the skies didn't crack open, and angels weren't sent from heaven shouting, "There's an undiscovered world out there! Journey forth from this suburban fog and live a grander, richer life!"
They slap their hands against the wall. You never trip, you never stumble.
At a very young age, I'd been bitten by the comedy bug, and this bug gave me the idea that I should strive to become the next John Belushi, Bill Murray, and John Candy all rolled into one. Thus, I went to the one place that could make that happen, the Second City. I enrolled in their high school improvisational classes, and thus began the shedding of my suburban cocoon and my entrance into a whole new world. Over the coming months, I became entrenched in the Second City scene. I started exploring the streets of Chicago, drugs, and different modes of expression and thought. The more this world expanded, the smaller Streamwood seemed to become. I'd befriended a guy who worked on the staff at the Second City by the name of Aaron Rhodes. Aaron was unlike any individual I'd ever known. The first time I'd met him, he was wearing hockey pants with the pads still in them and a pajama shirt. He talked at a rapid speed and deeply inhaled Marlboro Reds. He'd spew Eastern philosophy and how nothing really mattered. Through Aaron, I met a bunch of equally fascinating people, from bipolar writers to eccentric cartoonists and street hoods. Aaron also opened up my eyes to a whole new world of music. He'd play albums by Laurie Anderson, Elvis Costello, and Billie Holiday. Music that my Streamwood friends would call faggot music, or fucking stupid and gay. Streamwoodians are not really
known for their grand articulation of matters. One afternoon, after smoking some dirt weed, Aaron put on an album.
He got himself a homemade special. You know it's class.
A few notes probably hit my ears, and my brain began to buzz. Suddenly, I knew that the world I'd been looking for outside Streamwood was being discovered. What is this? I asked in a stunned manner. Rain Dogs, by Tom Waits, Aaron said, chomping on a plastic straw as he handed me the cassette case. As the strange and wonderful sounds came at me, I eyed the fellow on the cover and thought, who is this raving lunatic who creates such beautiful madness? What the fuck is this world? I wanted to crawl into the sounds I was hearing and live there. I wanted to be that guy stumbling through the streets in a wrinkled suit with a drunk girl on his arm. I didn't know what the fuck walking Spanish down the hall meant, and frankly, I still don't know if I do, but I wanted to experience it. I wanted to be that. I wanted to live it. I assumed that the secret to walking Spanish was in the rhythm of the guitar. If one could make their legs stride like that sound, one could be a cool-ass motherfucker, and with that would come a seedy hotel room with its sounds of distant neighbors fighting and police sirens and a corner trumpet player butchering the standards would fill the air. I asked Aaron if I could borrow the tape. Sure, ma'am, Aaron said as he exhaled a big cloud of smoke. Fuck it, you know what? Take it. It's yours. At home, I would sit in front of my Sears purchase compact stereo listening to Rain Dogs. I'd stare at the case as I listened along with the lyrics. He's got a homemade special. You know, his glass is full of sand, and it feels like a jaybird the way it feels in his hand. I never heard lyrics like this. I was used to, hey, hey, mama, say the way you move. I didn't know what these lyrics meant, but I wanted to understand. I wanted to drink bourbon out of dirty glasses on dangerous New York side streets. I wanted to roll a knife up in a trick towel, even though I didn't know what the fuck a trick towel was. I wanted to never trip and stumble. I never ended up living in this Tom Waitsian world I yearned for. I surely lived in my share of sketchy neighborhoods, and in my searches for drugs and weirdness, I wound up in some uneasy situations. However, when confronted by these worlds, I quickly realized that I was not truly made for the underbelly of society. I was a neurotic, not a smooth-talking street hustler cool guy. I'm all right with this, and at least I can get a nice dose of this world by putting on Rain Dogs in the privacy of my apartment and pretending that I got the soul that it takes to walk Spanish down the hall.
Downtown Train, track number 17, which surprisingly doesn't have as many uses of the word down than the earlier song Union Square. This song was covered by Johnny Cash, which you could see and hear online. This will be following track number 18, which also is a song without a writer. It is an instrumental called Bride of Rain Dog. You'll get a little snippet of both of those. And then we'll go straight into our last track, track number 19, Anywhere I Lay My Head. Dan Kerr-Hobert is a brand spanking new neo-futurist, but he's been in Chicago for quite a while. He is a writer, performer, and puppeteer. Here he is with the last track on the album, track 19, Anywhere I Lay My Head.
Outside another yellow moon is punched a hole in the nighttime, yes. I climb to the window and down to the street. I'm shining like a new dime. The downtown trains are full of all those Brooklyn girls. They try so hard to break out of their little worlds. Now you wave your hand in the sky. My heart is a-spinning round. My heart is in my shoes.
I started listening to Tom Waits when I was a freshman in college. It was in 99, and that was the year that Mule Variations came out. I started with Mule Variations and other tracks that I found on Napster and stuff, but it didn't take long until I really fell in love with Rain Dogs. You know, it's one of my favorites and was early on and has stayed, you know, I never get sick of listening to Rain Dogs. And the track that I'm covering is Anywhere I Lay My Head. It's the last track on the album. My brain always mixes it up with Train Song, actually, which I think it actually has a good, a strong relationship to. Mm-hmm. Train Song is, I broke down in East St. Louis on the Kansas uh-huh. City line. Mm-hmm. I spent up all of my money, which I borrowed every time. You know? So I always forget how short the song is, actually, too. But Anywhere I Lay My Head is like two verses, you know, short yeah. verses. It's not a very, it's a little poem, you know. But with that awesome outro, which I feel like might be maybe my favorite part of the song, too. But the song always sounded like weeping to me. So I fell in love with all of these songs while I was in conservatory learning about building a character and building a world and storytelling and stuff like that. And I so many times I would mention Tom Waits in voice classes. I had a teacher who was really into Elvis's voice and would always try and use Elvis's examples. And I would always bring up Tom Waits. And he'd be like, oh, yeah, he does. You know, he does what he does. But I think that the reason it was so compelling to me is that it was the, you know, he was using, sure, he was destroying his voice. I get that. And he has destroyed his voice, you know. He and Nick Nolte. The thing that always intrigued me, it's a song that evokes weeping and ends with a New Orleans jazz funeral, and it's the last track on an album. You know, Rain Dogs' cover, it's, you know, it's that mm-hmm. picture that looks like Tom Waits' head buried in mm-hmm. In that woman's neck. I don't know if you know, did you know
it's
that's not Tom Waits?
Waits?
It's not Tom Waits. It's an old photo from the 50s, 30s.
Really?
I found it somewhere. Yeah, it's like a Norwegian photographer. And I think there's something really kind of appropriate about this man, like, sleeping. He's not sleeping. What is he doing there?
He's
you know what
his
I mean?
Eyes
he's his eyes are closed and he's nesting there. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? And so much of the album is this crazy cast of world-weary people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is the thing that Waits does, right? He's built a house in the junkyard made of the shutters and the stovepipes mm-hmm. and the shingles and the tailpipes and whatever. Mm-hmm. He's created this crazy mansion of flack, of junk, and built American mythology out of it. And I think that's what's mm-hmm. resonant about it. I think that's what's special about it, is he's clearly, just like the authors of you know, the expats were curious about writing the great, they wanted to write the great American novel because they were trying to figure out what was distinctly American. I think that this is a similar pursuit. Like, yeah. what is the great American album?
Right.
And what does it mean to be an American songwriter? Mm-hmm. And I think in the late 20th century, early 21st century, it means being interested in all of the shards of musical trope and yeah. trying to shackle them all together and make something new out of it. And I think he has. And I think Rain Dogs was the first successful use of all the pieces that he was playing with up to that moment. And to finish that album with, I mean, obviously, the Jazz Funeral is a distinctly American phenomenon. And even those of us that it isn't part of our, like, we're not the, even if it's yeah. not your lineage, you can't help but be, you know, shaken to the core mm-hmm. by the Jazz Funeral, right? I mean, that is the part of America that America wants to be part of. It is a crown jewel of Americanism. And I think Anywhere I Lay My Head, is it the grave? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's I had a cousin when I moved here that was here, but no one else in mm-hmm. my family lived in Chicago. You know, like, Chicago was, I didn't know anybody here.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about the city, really. All I knew about the city was, you know, the mythology of Chicago, which is Sausage and the Blues Brothers and blues, and, you know, maybe I should have reversed the order of those. But to me, that song resonates because I made my home here. And Laying Your Head is, I guess, maybe a time-consuming process. I think on a large level, it speaks to that same thing, which is when we're trying to write the great American song, you can't tell the American story without talking about making a home out of something. I think that Anywhere I Lay My Head is part of the American psyche.
For better or for worse.
The American spirit is clearly exhibited in The Disenfranchised. Joy in the face of despair is summed up more clearly in The Jazz Funeral than in anything else I can think of.
Thank you, every one of you, for listening to episode 5 of Jughead's Basement.
the great album Rain Dogs by the even greater Tom Waits. Tune in next time on some day in some month, where we will be featuring Don't Back Down by The Queers, featuring interviews with Joe Queer, B-Face, Wimpy Rutherford, Mass Giorgini, and Lawrence Livermore. Thank you, and good night.
Thank you for listening to Jughead's Basement. Make sure to check out the other shows on the TNH Network right here at TuesdayNightHoot.com.